The Brad Sesmatt Show, broadcasting live.
It's good Tuesday. Thanks for being with us. We have a jam-packed show today. John Feinstein, we've not had John on in quite some time. Washington Post columnist, noted author, has written north of 40 books. His latest book, Raise a Fist, Take a Knee, Race and the Illusion of Progress in Sports, is out. I want to talk to John. He saw Houston over the weekend in Pittsburgh. In Houston, of course, taking on the University of Arizona on Thursday. And whenever we have John on, we have to talk about Phil Mickelson and things other than just the typical sports stuff. That's what makes John Feinstein so great. We will have John with us coming up at 10:20. Matt Muehlbach. So we got into this discussion, got into the weeds about greatest University of Arizona guard, most spectacular of all time. And I've been hearing about Benedict Mathurin's name being in the top 10 of the NBA draft. How high could it go? Where would a guy like Matt Muehlbach with the Pac-12 Network, where would he rank? Of course, Matt, a great cat in his own right. Where would he put Benedict Mathurin in the pantheon of University of Arizona guards? And what does Tommy Lloyd need to clean up before we get into Thursday night Sweet 16 games? So Matt Muehlbach will be with us. And then Brett Boone from the Brett Boone podcast. We've not done any baseball. Spring training's about a week and a half in. There's games being played. I just want to mix it up a little bit and have Brett Boone on with us. Former major leaguer and, again, has a Brett Boone podcast. We'll look at the National League. How much spring training do these guys really need? And we'll look at the National League West with the Dodgers edition of Freddie Freeman, Tatis driving around on a motorcycle, Bob Melvin saying never again. And if you're playing for the Diamondbacks, what are you really playing for in the way that things are shaking out in the National League West? We'll get into all that with Brett Boone. So jam-packed lineup. Opening comments brought to you by Desert Financial Credit Union. Desert Financial Credit Union, taking care of you, taking care of your business. That is Desert Financial Credit Union. We do appreciate their ongoing support. You know, the news of the day, for me at least, is about what's going to happen on Thursday in San Antonio. Jordan Hamm from our staff is going to be in San Antonio with the Wildcats for the game against Houston. Kirk Creasa was 1 of 10 from three-point shooting, but Kirk Creasa brings an awful lot of energy to the floor. What does Tommy Lloyd see in Kirk Creasa feeding the post? I talked about it yesterday. Houston is better at crashing the boards than TCU. They're number 3 in the nation in rebounding. TCU was number 1, so you got a preview of what it's going to look like. And the Cats, you know, in a lot of corners, people are picking Houston to pull the upset over the University of Arizona. So we'll talk with John Feinstein and Matt Muehlbach on that front. This is not a big story, but it's a story nonetheless that I think needs to be mentioned in our community. There's a couple community stories today. One is the NAIA semifinals, and Jeff Rutter over at Arizona Christian got his team all the way to the NAIA semifinals last night, and they came up short by 12. ACU, the number 1 overall seed on their region, Len Munsell, the president over there. So ACU made a run. They came up short to Loyola of Louisiana. Good run there by Jeff Rutter's team. The other local story I'll get to in a second. The Suns play at Minnesota tomorrow. The gnashing of teeth over Mikal Bridges, minutes that he played, 50 the other day. Again, we're just passing time until we get to the postseason. And I don't get too high or too low off of any of this stuff. Get me within 10 to 5 games. At the end of the regular season, we'll get much further into the Suns. Rather than trying to sit here and break down what happens if they lose to Minnesota, does it mean they're teetering? Oh, my gosh, the world's coming to an end. No, it doesn't mean anything. So they play the T-Wolves tomorrow. LeBron last night. So there's stories that I see, and I don't sit here every day and just chase the big bull. It's easy to do Yankees, Mets, Jets, Giants, Cowboys, Aaron Rodgers, rinse, repeat, and throw LeBron in there. It's easy. Anybody could sit here and do that stuff. LeBron, though, last, and so I don't. So LeBron last night went for 38 against Cleveland, 40 miles from where he grew up. He's 37 years old, and he had a triple-double last night, and he had a hellacious dunk on Kevin Love. And Kevin Love was pretty funny about it on social media today. I like it when players have a little bit of a sense of humor, self-effacing about themselves. And Kevin Love clearly had that. If you follow him on social and you saw the dunk by LeBron and you see what Kevin Love put out, you would laugh too. But LeBron put up an enormous night at 38 points, 12 assists, and 11 rebounds. And are the Lakers going to get it figured out with Anthony Davis? And are the Lakers going to be a team the Suns meet in the playoffs? I can only hope. There are some things in life that I want in my sports calendar. And if I could have Suns, Lakers every year, I don't get wound up about Suns, Lakers in January, especially with this team. Like watching LeBron with a bunch of guys that can't really play or haven't figured it out or they're just not there. Like, don't be surprised if Russell Westbrook in about, I don't know, the next couple weeks, suddenly, wow, Russell Westbrook's playing really well. Yeah, because he's paced himself to get through the regular season. Don't be surprised, Anthony Davis. Whoa, AD, he looks great. Yeah, because he's been getting hurt or being held out. So on and so on it goes. Give me Suns, Lakers, and that will make my April or my May on the sports calendar. I love that kind of drama. The Atlanta Falcons traded Matt Ryan. We've been talking about Matt Ryan and his contract in regards to where we're at with our hometown hero, Kyler Murray. Kyler Murray is not in a space where his agent is happy at all. Kyler Murray hasn't said much. Kyler showed up last night on social at the Dallas Mavericks game. He's letting his agent do the talking or the tweeting, as it were. And it's not sitting well with fans here in Arizona. But the quarterback market in the NFL, because it's been so busy and so active, and the place where it is most volcanic, I would say, is right here in our hometown. Our hometown heroes have a ton of cap space, and they've done nothing with it so far. DeAndre Hopkins restructures his deal. Done nothing with it so far. Kyler Murray's agent goes on the offensive again on social with Davante Adams. I guess I could put, or I should put, the situation in Cleveland right alongside of what's going on here in our own backyard. Because Deshaun Watson has 24 accusers, and in the legalese of the NFL, they have a clause that he may have violated. Well, right now, it's all accusations. So they're not going to sit down to Deshaun Watson. Meantime, Baker Mayfield's sitting over here saying, hey, I can do all my progressive commercials that were obnoxious, like too many, way too many commercials for a guy that didn't play all that great. And he's not going to be the guy in Cleveland unless the NFL rules on Deshaun Watson. So you can have quarterback controversies. You can have quarterback questions. Jameis Winston is going to be back with the New Orleans Saints. Mitchell Trubisky is going to be the guy with the Steelers, question mark. That's fine. You can bounce around the league. But in Arizona, you have an agent for a quarterback who apparently is disgruntled. But when all this gets through, whatever the outcome, Kyler's going to say, here's what he's going to say. I let my agent handle all the talking. He's not going to say, I feel disrespected. I deserve a lot more money. Why are they paying guys like Matt Ryan and Kirk Cousins eight times what I'm getting paid right now? He's not going to say that. And he's going to say things like, well, this is just part of the business, and this is how it goes, and I'm just here to play football, and I let my agent handle all that. You can be as mad at him as you want, but I'm telling you, that's how it's going to play out here with Kyler. That's how it's going to go. Unless Michael Bidwell just does not like being backed into a corner, which is my theory, and something happens here in Arizona that we would never have thought would happen. He needlessly extended the head coach. I'd say the same thing about the general manager. And the agent has doubled down on his attack on the Cardinals organization. And so, you know, as this is playing out, you see the Atlanta Falcons say, okay, we're not going to pay Matt Ryan this much dough, even though it's going to be dead cap space on their deal. And they sign Marcus Mariota. The market out there, if the Cardinals decided we're not going to play ball here, we're going to have you sit and rot, or we're going to have you, you know, shipped off, whatever it may be. Forget about the financial implications for a moment. Just on pure principle, I don't see the Cardinals, what would be perceived as caving in to an agent. It's just not going to happen with this owner. It's not. So it is fascinating because it just continues. There's a little nitpick here, spitwad there, poof, you know. All right, John Feinstein on the other side. Columnist, Washington Post, 23 New York Times bestsellers. John Feinstein saw Houston last weekend. What is the U of A walking into? It's a future for Phil Mickelson and much more, with one of the best in the business. John Feinstein, that's next. All right, as promised, John Feinstein is with us. It's been a long time since we've had John on board, columnist with the Washington Post, celebrated author. There's so much to get into with John. His new book, Raise a Fist, Take a Knee, Race and the Illusion of Progress in Sports, came out last November. He saw Houston play. U of A plays Houston on Thursday night. I also want to talk to John about Jerry Colangelo, Bobby Hurley, ties of Coach K, and Phil Mickelson. So there's plenty to get to with Valley Ties with the great John Feinstein. How are you?
Brad, I'm good. It's good to talk to you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been. Thanks so much. And just first of all, big overview, John, the tournament from your perspective, a weekend. What do you see? What do you like? What kind of shifts you one way to the other?
Well, I loved St. Peter's. I think we all did. We're all looking for the great underdog story the first week. And St. Peter's was probably an upset that almost nobody other than very devoted St. Peter's fans had. I go so far back with St. Peter's. I remember them in the 1968 NIT when I was a kid, and they had a player named Elnardo Webster. And in the first round, I used to go to the whole tournament in Madison Square Garden in those days growing up in New York. In the first round, they beat Duke. And I thought that was fantastic because I rooted for the New York teams as a kid. And so I believe it or not, I saw their opening game this season because I did their game at VCU. And I was impressed with their team. They lost by about four to a good VCU team in a very tough place to play. And I thought Shaheen Holloway had something going. Now, would I have said after that game, they're going to make the tournament and they're going to beat Kentucky? No, of course not. And remember, they went into the MAC tournament as an underdog. The number one seed was Iona. And they won that tournament and they're still going. So that, to me, that's just a wonderful story. And we had the usual upsets that occur, some upsets that aren't really upsets. I mean, Michigan's out of the Big Ten. So them beating Tennessee isn't that shocking, although Tennessee was playing very well. And I was – Rick Barnes is a friend, so I was disappointed by that outcome. And as per usual, it seems, the Big Ten bombed out. They had nine teams. There are only two left playing. The ACC has three left playing. When they only had five to start with. And, of course, the Pac-12 has Arizona and UCLA. And I think either of those teams could make the Final Four or both could make the Final Four.
I think the depth, you mentioned the ACC, having Miami go in there. And on the other side, I was just done with the Big Ten. Just done with it, John. Like, okay, I get it. You guys have a great TV contract. You want to bang us over the head about how great your conference is. And then they just fizzle.
Right. Well, remember, Brad, the last time they won a national championship was Michigan State in 2000. 2000.
Yeah.
So
it's like the Pac-12.
Villanova's won two more championships in this century than the Big Ten. Just one example. North Carolina's won three more. And Duke's won two. But the point is that you're right about the TV. Who do they have their main TV contract with? CBS.
Yep.
Who televises the NCAA tournament? CBS. Who was one of the great powers in NCAA basketball for years? Jim Delaney, who was the commissioner of the Big Ten until a couple of years ago. So this isn't coincidence that this it seems to happen every year. The Big Ten gets all these bids. And then by the second week, we're all saying, well, the Big Ten was overrated. And again, the Big Ten was overrated. We'll see what Michigan and Purdue can do. I think Purdue's capable of making the Final Four. I would love to see that for Matt Painter because I think he's like his mentor, Gene Cady, a great coach who's never quite made the Final Four.
John Feinstein with us for a few minutes. You saw Houston in Pittsburgh over the weekend. They play Arizona Thursday night in San Antonio. What'd you make out of Kelvin Sampson's team, John?
Well, I think they're dangerous because they play defense. And Kelvin Sampson, for all the issues he had at Oklahoma and Indiana, he basically destroyed the Indiana program when he was there, is a great defensive coach. And he improved as an offensive coach when he was out of college coaching because he worked in the NBA and he learned about more about offense while he was there. And this is a team that, you know, was in the Final Four last year, but never played a single digit seed. en route. The draw opened up for them. And then when they had to play Baylor, we all know what happened because everybody got crushed by Baylor last year, except for Villanova in a round of 16. So they're dangerous because they guard. They're dangerous because they're quick. They wore Illinois down with their quickness, I think, late in the game on Sunday. And I think they'll be a tough out for Arizona. So was TCU.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Houston seems even more physical on the glass, just watching them. Yeah, yeah. The Coach K tour, what do you make out of it, given your Duke ties and just the love of sport that you have in college basketball? What did you make out of it over the weekend? Did you find yourself saying, this is really good theater, him against Izzo and all of that?
Well, he against Izzo has always been good theater. I think this was the 16th time they'd met and the fourth or fifth time in the NCAA tournament. But I'll be honest, I understand why Mike made the announcement when he did. It was for recruiting because he didn't feel he could go into homes and have kids say to him, Coach, will you be coaching me? Mm-hmm. And he didn't want to lie. And he knew that the minute he said, no, this is my last year. I think last year would have been his last year, to be honest, Brad, if not for the pandemic, if not for the way the season was and for his team having a bad year, too. But he was turning 75. He knew it was time. I think he feels the hours that he has always spent coaching more now at 75. Hell, I feel the hours that I spent working a lot more now than when you and I first met. He felt he had to make the announcement for recruiting. I don't think he wanted the victory tour, and I don't think he anticipated it turning out to be, you know, such a nonstop ongoing story for everyone. I mean, I'll be honest. I love Mike Krzyzewski. I've known him since he was a coach at Army. Mm-hmm. I'd be thrilled if he went into the national championship. But whenever this ends, whether it's Thursday or a week from Monday or sometime in between, I'll breathe a sigh of relief. And I think he will too. And then a little while later, he's going to have to figure out what he's going to do. Right. He doesn't play golf. You can only spend so much time with all the grandchildren we've all gotten to know intimately in the last few months. He's going to need to find something to keep him busy because he's that kind of a guy. He's not going to sit around drinking wine and reading books.
Do you think he shows up at games at Duke or is he just disappear? We never see him again.
It's a very good question. Dean Smith always stayed away. John Wooden went to every game.
Right.
I think he'll be some, he's still going to live in Durham. He's still going to have an office at Duke. He's still on the Duke payroll as an ambassador for Duke, whatever the heck that means. Mm-hmm. But I think he'll let John Shire guide him. If John says, hey, we're playing so-and-so, and I'd love for you to be there, he'll go. But he won't show, I don't think he'll show up at every game.
I remember.
But for John Shire's sake, I hope not.
Yeah. I remember getting started in the business, growing up in Southern California, and working in the L.A. market, and I'd go to a UCLA game, and media would always walk over to Coach Wooden. What do you think? And the Bruins lost tonight, and here's what Coach Wooden said after the game, you know.
I don't think he intended to make life more difficult for those who succeeded him, but he did. You know, first of all, just by winning 10 championships in 12 years, how do you even come close to matching that? I mean, Jim Harrick won a national title, and UCLA couldn't wait to get rid of him.
Right.
Same thing happened to Bill Guthridge. He went to two Final Fours in 3 years, and they had a victory parade when he retired in Chapel Hill. So, and that's why it's going to be tough on John Shire. Mike said to me after the Shire hire, you know, John is in a better position at 33 to coach in the ACC than I was when I got there at 33 because he's played in the league, he's coached in the league, which Mike had never done. And I said, there's one difference. And he said, what's that? I said, you didn't have to follow you. And that's going to be the biggest thing John Shire has to deal with.
Where do Bobby Hurley and Jerry Colangelo fall in the Mike Krzyzewski story?
Well, Bobby Hurley hit the biggest shot of Mike Krzyzewski's career. And you might say, whoa, what about Christian Laettner against Connecticut? What about Christian Laettner more famously against Kentucky in 92? But in 91, when Duke was trying to upset that undefeated Nevada Las Vegas team that had beaten them by 30 in the championship game a year earlier, Vegas got up 76-71 with a little more than 2 minutes left in the game. And Krzyzewski wanted to call time because he felt his team kind of gasping. And Bobby did, in those days, a player had to call timeout on the court when the ball was live. And Bobby, nobody saw Mike standing up to signal timeout. And Bobby stepped into a seam and made a three. And then Duke called timeout. And then the lead was two. And then the pressure built on Vegas because they'd never been in a close game that year. And Pete Newell, the great Pete Newell, said to Mike that summer, listen, Leitner's been great, but that Hurley kid hit the biggest shot of your career when he made that shot. And then, of course, he threw that pass to Grant Hill in the championship game that should have gone in the third row, as Bobby will tell you. And then Grant made one of the all-time great plays to bring it back from behind his head and dunk it. Bobby was an incredible player at Duke who got better every year and worked at his game. And who knows what kind of a pro he would have been if not for the accident. And right. I'm still a big Bobby Hurley fan as a human. I know they had a down year this year, but if I know Bobby, they'll be back next year. Jerry Colangelo was the guy who, along with others, pushed for Mike to coach the Olympic team. And because they won three gold medals, people forget that when he first got the job, there was a lot of criticism. How can he coach NBA players? He's never been an NBA coach. He doesn't even know the international rules, although he had coached internationally already with college players earlier in his career. And we all know what happened. They won three straight gold medals. It was Colangelo basically who talked Mike into coming back that third time to coach in South America, Rio de Janeiro, because he was basically done after the second time. He'd done it. He'd won. He'd proved himself. He was thrilled, of course. But Colangelo was smart. He appealed to Mike's patriotism. Well, you're talking about a guy who served in the United States Army. That's the way to go.
That's good. I want to circle back on Hurley. Just one other question about Bobby, and that is, did it surprise you that he was not the successor to Mike Krzyzewski?
Not really. I think, again, with a lot of the ex-players who were head coaches, there were a lot of them who weren't sure if they wanted to be the guy mm-hmm. who succeeded the guy. Tommy Amaker, who did turn down the job, he was actually offered the job, had told me years ago that he wanted to be the guy who succeeded the guy, the way Roy Williams ultimately did at North Carolina. Because walking into those shoes is going to be difficult for anybody. I think Bobby thought about that. I think Mike Bray thought about that, although I think Mike wanted an ex-player. I think Chris Collins, Johnny Dawkins, all those guys thought about that. And I don't know what Bobby would have done had the job been offered to him, to be honest.
Yeah, and I hope that Bobby gets a new building out here because, honestly, John, he's been coaching with one arm and one leg. He's like the Black Knight of Monty Python out here. Just he's in a barn and can't even bring recruits through. And he's doing a hell of a good job out here in spite of...
He's a terrific coach. I mean, yeah. Look what he did at Buffalo, for crying out loud.
Yeah, yeah. Before I get you out of here, we're talking with John Feinstein. The Phil Mickelson story, Phil, of course, ASU grad. John, he's never going to be able to get back the Phil Mickelson that we know or not.
No, he won't. There are certain things that, you know, like Bob Knight, you know, in the first three paragraphs of his obituary will be the chair throw, even though he won three national championships, coached an Olympic gold medal team, and is probably should be on the Mount Rushmore of coaches, college coaches. I mean, Mount Rushmore is John Wooden, Mike Krzyzewski, Bob Knight, Dean Smith. But I think that one sec, Brad. One sec.
Hey, this is live. This is live.
We don't mind. Can you stop playing for about 2 minutes?
It's really good. What? It's really good playing. I wasn't going to say anything.
No, she's very good.
He's very good, very John. Good. I like it.
I became famous, though, or my older daughter, Bridget, became famous, though, because she was playing the drums when I did an interview with Jim Rome about 20 years ago. And I asked her three times to stop playing the drums, and she ignored me the way daughters will do. Yeah. And finally, I put my hand on the phone, and I said, Bridget, stop it. And she did stop. But Jim said, does she take requests? And I said, apparently not from me. And he uses that cut every year on his best of show at the end of the year. So yeah. My daughter, Bridget, became famous at that moment. But Jane is very good on the piano, but I apologize.
No question.
What he said was unbelievable. And Phil's a bright guy.
Right.
And yet he has had a tendency through his career to put his foot in his mouth, you know, complaining about taxes in California when he was making $70 million a year. publicly saying that Tiger Woods' equipment wasn't very good when Tiger was kicking everybody's butt. But this was the worst by far. I mean, basically what he said, if you boil down the quote, and I've known Alan Shipnick for as long as I've known Phil, which is almost 30 years. And Alan Shipnick doesn't misquote people. He doesn't quote people off the record. All the years I've known Phil, he's never gone off the record, which is one of the things I like about him.
Yeah.
And a couple of times he said things to me that I said, you don't want to say that because you protect your sources. And Phil was always good with me. But he basically said, if you boil down the quote, these guys are murderers, but I take their money.
Right.
You can't say that. Yeah. You shouldn't even think that. And when he tried to claim it was off the record, which, again, I'm sure it wasn't, that's worse. Yeah. To say, hey, listen, by the way, don't tell anybody, but I'm going to work for a bunch of murderers if they pay me enough. And so what he needs to do, Brad, whenever he comes back to play, he's not playing the Masters, apparently. Whenever he comes back to play, he needs to say, I'm so sorry. Not a Tiger Woods non-apology apology, not his non-apology earlier. I'm so sorry. I was wrong to think it, to say it. I hope people will forgive me, because sports fans do forgive their heroes.
No, that's true. That's true. Before I get you out of here one last time, raise a fist, take a knee, raise the illusion of progress in sports. We saw Steve Wilks here for one season with the Arizona Cardinals as the head coach, and he was showing the door. This book you put out in November, it's terrific, John. And what's been the feedback to you on it?
Well, it's been unbelievably positive, Brad. I said while I was researching it that to friends of mine that I felt this was the most important book I've ever written. As you mentioned, I've written 44 books because of the subject, because race is the elephant in the room in our country and in sports. Sports has tended to be ahead of the country in general. Jackie Robinson played for the Dodgers 7 years before the Supreme Court desegregated schools. And that's always been the case. I mean, for crying out loud, Jim Crow existed in the South till 1965. But I talked to a lot of people, a lot of coaches, black coaches who felt, I mean, Lovie Smith is another great example. Here's a guy who went to a Super Bowl with Rex Grossman as his quarterback, went 10-6 a couple of years later and got fired. And so, you know, looking up numbers, you mentioned Steve Wilks. Black coaches not only have a harder time getting hired, they have a harder time not getting fired. The leash is much shorter for them. You know, Mike Tomlin is safe because he's never had a losing season and he's won a Super Bowl and been to two. But most black coaches are vulnerable. And in the Brian Flores story coming out 6 weeks after this book was published was absolute proof of that. Here's a guy who coached for 3 years in an organization that had been down, had back-to-back winning seasons, and in his first season, apparently was under pressure to lose from the ownership, and he gets fired. And I there's a lot more. There's a lot about – I was fortunate. I got to talk to John Thompson at length before he got sick during COVID and passed away. And I talked to Nolan Richardson. I talked to all the early black quarterbacks, Doug Williams, who won the first Super Bowl as a black quarterback in 1988, wrote the foreword for me. I've known Doug forever. So it was a very, I'm trying to think of the right word, gratifying project.
Yeah.
The book hasn't been on the bestseller list, but the reviews, honestly, Brad, are probably the best I've ever gotten.
You have one in your net that's coming up. Is this it for right now?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Is this your last book for now, or do you have one you're working on?
I'm working on a book on David Faraday, who I think is first of all, he's a great guy, but he's an unbelievable story. Grew up during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Most people know he's battled alcoholism all his life. He was a very good player in Europe, played on the Ryder Cup team in 1991, beat Payne Stewart in the singles. And his stories about that day at Kiawah Island, the war by the shore, are great stories, and he's just interviewing him is fun because he's so funny. So it's a book I'm very much looking forward to digging farther into.
That sounds great. I need a favor from you on the way out, and that's ask your daughter to play some exit music. This is like, you know,
what kind of music do you want?
Exit music, just so you know, you're being called. Play something. I'll just tell
you
goodbye.
Come in here, please.
Yeah, yeah. If she's got some exit music. You
the
know,
gentleman who's interviewing me wants to hear you play a song as we end our interview.
Exit music. Whatever it may be.
It's
Okay, well, what song do you play really well?
Yeah.
Play Someday. Okay. She's going to play Someday, Brad.
Really loud.
Really loud, Jane.
Yeah, with all passion that you'd want. And John, I appreciate the time. We'll let her play her exit music. It's been great catching up with you on so many different subjects. It's good to see you, and you're well.
My pleasure, Brad. And you can see who the real talent in the family is.
Let's see. She sounds good there in the background. I'll let you go off that, John. Thanks.
I can't hear you over the piano, but that's okay, right?
Bye-bye. See you, John.
There's a million.
John Feinstein, and we're back with more after this timeout. All right, as promised, Matt Muehlbach for a few minutes on all things. The Wildcat Guard, Pac-12 Network analyst across the globe. He looks at a matchup of Arizona and Houston on the Sweet 16 front that is Thursday. But I want to start with this conversation, Matt, on guards and Arizona. And Mr. Mathrin has been terrific. There's been a lot that has been said. Fans are already wanting to put him in the pantheon of U of A guards. And as you being in that pantheon, Matt, where would you put Benedict Mathrin?
Oh, where does he come in?
Yeah.
Wow. I think he's high up there. He's high up there. Now, I had this conversation with someone the other day. It's kind of interesting because, you know, I think we start to think of guys that have been at U of A for 4 years, you know, guys like Sean Elliott and, you know, Gilbert Arenas, I think was he 3 years? Mm-hmm. And, you know, people like that, you know, Jason Gardner and Miles Simon and Michael Dickerson and all these great guards, but, you know, they've been there 4 years and, you know, there's obviously a great chance that Benedict's only going to be there too. And so, you know, where do those guys rank, you know, if they haven't really, you know, played those all those 4 years and kind of like, I guess, you know, gotten into the, as you said, the pantheon of the guards, but, you know, become a Wildcat, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And becoming, certainly, becoming a Wildcat, meaning off the floor too, as well as on the floor, right? Because you guys are playing off the floor.
Yeah, part of those teams and the community and so forth. And I think we've seen it a little bit the opposite way with guys that have been one and done, where, you know, you sort of forget about them a little bit, right? They come into to Tucson and part of the Wildcats for a year, and then they're gone, and they don't really have that sort of staying power that we think of some of the 4 year guys. But I'll tell you, I think Benedict Mathrin is really big time. He's legit. You know, I had a text message the other day with somebody that, you know, he's probably like in the top 13 of he's in the lottery right mm-hmm. now, the NBA draft. You know, Brad, I really think it's possible he could be in the top five, maybe even the top three, the way he's playing. Now, there's still a lot to go. And, you know, he's still got a lot to do in this tournament. They're only in the second week. But the second week is where it kind of separates, right? We've had a lot of guys over the years get to that second weekend. And if you can get to the third weekend, you become pretty immortal in the sort of U of A history. So we'll see what they can do. They've got obviously a really tough road. They play a Houston team that's probably just like TCU, mm-hmm. better. It's just a better version of TCU. So they got their hands full. But I do love the fact that they have a week or – you know, whatever, half a week to prepare. I think Tommy Lloyd will do a great job in preparation, and should be a heck of a game against kind of our old Pac-12 buddy, Kelvin Sampson. Remember how good he was back in Washington State years ago. So
Matt Muehlbach with us for a few minutes as we're talking about U of A and guards and looking ahead to Houston. On Mathrin's front, when you first saw him to where he is now, where has he improved the most? Either end of the floor, ball handling, defense, whatever it is, where has he improved the most?
I think it's just his will to win and his will to, you know, to be a factor in the game and his will to be an impact. You know, I think we saw, you know, early on, you could just see the, you know, the raw talent, if you will. And it was interesting because you don't often get a guy that has such a range of, hey, he's an unbelievable shooter, but he's also an incredible athlete, right? And he can kind of do all those things together. And I think, but when I saw him, I saw someone who was, you know, inconsistent, didn't really understand how to play at the highest level yet. Obviously just a, you know, a young kid and, right, and trying to grow into, you know, what he could be. But what I've seen is like taking all that into a game and into a team concept and becoming, you know, I talked about it last week, the most free throws he ever shot for his career was 11 heading into the Pac-12 tournament. He had 15 in the championship game against against UCLA, and he had 13 the other night against TCU. To me, that told me, you know, he took over the game. He was getting to the free throw line. That's what great, you know, scorers, that's what great dominating players do. And just the emotion that he showed, you know, and how many different plays did we see that emotion on his dunk? You know, the incredible dunk he had on that give and go with Coloco, you know, the backdoor dunk, just all the different plays he had. I didn't see that at all a year ago when he started at the U of A. And so his taking all that talent and becoming all the intangibles, right? The will, the caring, the wanting to win, the competitiveness. Didn't see it a year and a half ago when he started, and it's come out to me. It's really blossomed and flourished in this last month or so.
Yeah, he has a presence about him, Matt. I think in Vegas, I chatted with him a bit. They had the stuff at the podium, and then afterwards, just for a moment. And there's just a kind of a presence of I belong here, even in handling his media obligations, which is part of becoming greatness to me.
Yeah, definitely. And you didn't really see, like, the first year, you didn't really see the personality.
Right.
He was pretty quiet, really quiet kid, inconsistent. You know, again, I'm not saying it as a criticism. It's just, it's what young kids do. He was 17 or 18. And I asked him, he had a funny play against Washington about a month and a half ago at Washington, where he had a breakaway. And he went up to do like a windmill dunk, and he basically got in the air and didn't know what to do. And he came down and totally missed it. It was a kind of a, you know, shacked in a fool, you know, situation, if you will. And I asked him about it the next game, cause I had their game, and he was super funny about it. You know, his personality came out. He said, you know, I got up in the air and I wanted to do like a two-hand windmill, not a one-hand. And I got up and I got like kind of like stuck, and in my mind, I didn't know what I was really going to do. And he laughed about it. He thought it was super funny. And that to me was, I hadn't seen that also, you know, come out. So to your point, you know, kind of understanding, hey, look, you know, personality, dealing with the media, having fun, you know, some of the other things that you have to deal with seems to be coming out with this kid. So pretty cool.
Matt Muehlbach with us as U of A gets ready to take on Houston. That will be on Thursday night. All right, let's go through some things here coming off of San Diego in these days of preparation. So Houston pounds the glass on the offensive end. TCU pounded U of A on the offensive glass. If anything you could take away from that, it's a teaching moment for Tommy Lloyd to say, we have to be better at this, guys. So that was my big takeaway. One, two, I felt like they got away from Coloco a little bit in the second half. He was having his way inside. Big man for TCU had four fouls with 12 minutes to go. They couldn't get him out of the game. Two areas I look at, Matt, going into the game on Thursday. Do you see other things, or are those two that you focus on as well?
Yeah, so three areas to me. You mentioned two of them. I think number one, defensive rebounding. TCU was number one in the country. Houston's number three. So it's almost the same team you're playing, right? And I'm with you. I felt like they settled a lot for threes at times, that they could have gotten it inside, and they were having so much success inside. A reason that two of those things happened is that, you know, Tabellus didn't play a lot, and
right,
he didn't have his best game. And, you know, Tommy mentioned it after the game, said, hey, I didn't play him a lot. He might be a little upset at me, but, you know, he didn't play well early. And so he went a little smaller. That may have cost him a little bit on the glass, may have cost him a little bit on that high, low inside stuff, because they kind of were playing, you know, four wings and Coloco or Balo. They did play Balo and Coloco a fair amount together like they do, but I think we're going to see a much better Tubelis on Thursday. I think he'll be ready. I think he'll play a lot better. I've said all year that to me, he's like that key mismatch, because the other team doesn't have anybody as big as Koloko. They have to put their biggest guy in Koloko. And usually most teams don't have a second guy that you can then bring in that's 6'11", 260. So, yeah, right. And so that's the mismatch that they take advantage of a lot. And with him, you know, not having his best game and so forth, I think that hurt him a little bit. So I think that those two things are huge. And I think with a week, or as I said, a half a week to prepare, I think Tommy will be really good with those two things. I think the third thing is the balance of this team on turnovers, right? Houston turns you over a lot. They get their hands on deflections. They really are good at stealing the ball from you and making you uncomfortable. And I think that, you know, this team, and again, it's not necessarily a criticism, Tommy Lloyd does a great job of letting them play. Mm-hmm. And so he doesn't want to, you know, upset that sort of beautiful like poetry they have out there on the court and the freedom that they have. And I've said this all season, it reminds me of the Warriors. You know, if you watch the Warriors, the one thing that they do a lot is they turn it over. But at the same time, you watch Steve Curry, he's very careful not to like, you know, put the reins on the geniuses of Steph and Clay and Draymond and all these guys. He wants them to go, but then you see him over there sort of, you know, gritting his teeth when they turn it over a bunch. So, but, and that's fine when there's a lot of possessions. If you play an up and down game, there's a ton of possessions, they have 16, 17 turnovers, they can get away with that. Mm-hmm. The problem occurs though, when you play a team like Houston, that slows it down. Tempo is a big thing, not as many possessions. And also they can not only turn you over, but that makes them, you know, really good on offense, because now they convert it to 2 points. So I know Tommy's going to, you know, that's a really tough balance to try and walk that tightrope. So I think to me, those are the three keys that I see in the game.
Yeah. And let me go back on the shooting of the threes, the contested threes. I don't have a problem if it's putting threes up, but
yeah,
when they're contested and you got to feed the big man on occasion, Koloko was kind of 11 halfway through the second half. Like, come on, guys. And maybe that's just me being a big stiff at 6'8", saying, come on, feed the big man, you know. What about Kreisa?
You'd like to get the ball inside. You love it.
Yeah. What about Kreisa? What do you make out of Kreisa the other night? The numbers, just having him back, not having him back. Is he 100%? Do you start him? How do you handle that one going into this game?
Well, you know, my guess is he's going to feel even better by Thursday. If he was playing, you know, on Sunday, should be better by Thursday. Maybe there's a little swelling, but, you know, so take away the shooting for a second. Obviously, he didn't shoot it well, but take that away. I thought he was terrific. You know, the energy he brings, the pace he plays with is what makes this team go. He plays with such unbelievable pace. You watch like other point guards of teams, they just walk the ball up, you know, and he is just, he's sprinting every time he touches it, and it just gets them in rhythm. The whole team is in such rhythm when he plays. I thought he was really good on defense. The announcers were kept saying, go at Kreisa. And, you know, Steve Smith was one of the announcers, which total NBA guy, which is smart. Like he's like his, in his mind, he's like, hey, I'm going at the one guy who's got a, you know, sore ankle,
right?
And may not be the best defender anyway, but so on top of it, he's got the ankle, and I thought that was a great call. But I thought Kreisa was good defensively. He moved his feet. He looked quick to me. I didn't see any real residue of the injury. The shooting, okay, you don't want to be 1 for 10, but that goes back to Tommy Lloyd and the balance of, you know, with these guys. He wants them to attack. He says, let it fly. I mean, so it's hard to talk out of, you know, both sides of your mouth when you say let it fly. But then, so I think with Kreisa, it's what you just said. It's be mindful of good shots, right? You don't want contested 25 footers. If they're uncontested, he's a heck of a shooter and he should take them and he should hunt them. He should look for them. But if they're contested, hey, you know, have some discretion around that. And I think he will on Thursday.
Yeah, to use the NBA point a little bit further that Steve Smith did, I've gotten so much hate email on Kreese, and I love watching him play, but I equate it to Danny Ainge when he was in the NBA. If he's not on your team, you're going to hate him. That's just right. How it is. And right. When he's on your team, you love him. When he's not on your team, that's the guy. That's the villain. And the beauty of sports is if you have villains on the floor, it makes it that much more fun.
It does. And I did a game earlier this year with Cindy Brunson, who lives in Phoenix.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Cindy. And she came up with the Danny Ainge comparison. I thought it was an awesome comp. And that's kind of who he is. You know, he actually plays a little bit like him. You know, he doesn't play as much inside as Ainge. Ainge was bigger and played inside, but just the attitude and all of that is very Danny Ainge.
Yeah. What do you think happens Thursday night?
You know, I think KenPom has Houston winning by a point. I actually like Arizona being to some degree a tiny bit of an underdog right now. Like everybody's saying, hey, they sort of faced, you know, death in the eye on Sunday and got away with it. That to me has a good feeling of a team. It reminds me almost of the 95 UCLA team when Tyus Edney had to hit that late shot against Missouri in the second round.
Up at Boise, right? It was at Boise.
It was up in Boise. Yeah, the blue court. Yep. But it gives you a sense of, okay, we've faced elimination. Like it was right in our sight and we avoided it. And I think that helps them play free. And I actually like the position they're in. I love the fact in a way that they play a team that's similar. So they can at least attack those things that hurt them on Sunday. And I think I go back to UCLA, the first game at Pauley. UCLA did an unbelievable job at Pauley. And they were really physical with Arizona. They kind of bullied them a little bit. And if you watch the next game, Tommy Lloyd did an unbelievable job adjusting to that. And they set some high screens. They ran some guys into ball screens. And they played really tough in that second game. And then I'll give you another example. They got bullied a little bit in Colorado. And what happened two nights later or three nights later in USC, they played the best half they've played all season at SC. I kind of feel like that might happen this week. I kind of feel like giving Tommy the 5 days or 4 days is going to be really helpful. And I like him. I like him Thursday.
Good stuff. I appreciate your time and insights. As always, it's good to catch up, Matt. Stay safe.
Yeah, you too, Brett. Look forward to seeing you.
There's Matt Muehlbach with us with the Pac-12 Network, and we're back with more after this timeout. All right, as promised, let's turn our attention to some baseball with U of A going on to the final, or Sweet 16, I should say. Look at me getting ahead of myself to the Final Four, but the Sweet 16. We want to get to some baseball because Cactus League is in full run here in the Valley now, which is great for the economy. It's great for all the teams to be out here. We want to have Brett Boone back with us. Brett Boone, of course, 3-time All-Star, 4-time Gold Glover, Major League Baseball, Inside and Out, the Boone Podcast. You can find it, the Boone Podcast. Look at you. You're all decked out.
Ready to go. A little golf today, Brad.
Little golf or a lot of golf, Brett? How's this going to go?
A lot of golf. We'll see how well my back holds up. But planning on a lot today, at least 27.
There you go. And you're in Florida. And I just want to talk to you first and foremost about, you know, the impact of the shortened spring training from a baseball player's standpoint. You're there in Florida where there's a grapefruit circuit out here, the Cactus League. Players have to be thrilled that there's not as much, or are they not, when it comes to spring training? Let's start there.
Well, I think you break it down, the pitchers and the position player. Position players, this is a dream for us, you know, to strap it on 3 weeks, you're out of there. Pitchers usually need a little more time to get ready to build up to that 5-6 inning, especially for the starters. But we've always said all along, you know, that the season gets long now with the extended playoffs, and it's been in talks since I can remember, 20, 30 years, we need to shorten spring training. But as you mentioned in the open, the economies of Arizona and Florida heavily, you know, they depend on this each and every year. So getting it shortened, I don't think you're going to do that. Normally when we get to spring training, we start the games, we really ease into it. I just think you're going to see a little bit more hate, a little bit more let's go. We got to go now. So you're going to see the main guys getting a lot more at bats earlier in the spring than you normally would.
So in terms of the start of the season, will we see better play? Managers going to manage differently with their arms out there saying, okay, if we had a couple more weeks, I'd stretch this guy into the 100 pitch count range thereabouts.
I think that's pretty accurate. And I think they've extended the roster. If I'm not mistaken, I think it's 28 instead of 26. So they're going to give it the probably two extra arms down there in the bullpen. So, yeah, I think early in the season, you're definitely going to see the skippers side on the side of caution versus pushing their, especially their big boys out of the gate. So, yeah, I think you're going to see a lot of openers, which has been kind of the new thing in Major League Baseball. And I think you're going to see them ease in, but I these guys won't miss a beat. The talent, the players in 2022, Brad, they're around the clock. It's 24/7. These guys didn't miss a beat when they had to get to spring training. They knew at any time the deal could be struck and they needed to be ready to go. Those guys were throwing their bullpens. The only thing you can't replace, you can be as fit as you want, as great a shape as you want. You can't replace that game activity. You can't replace big league pitcher on the mound, in the batter's box, umpire behind home plate. That's the only thing you need. And for these hitters, it's just getting your timing. Some guys get it in a week. Some guys take 3-4 weeks. So it'll be interesting. It'll be the same as usual. Some guys will get off to a hot start. Some guys cold, but you'll have a full 162. I think that's been mistaken in all this lockout talk is the fact that they did recover the entire season, 162, because you know there's going to be the naysayers out there. Well, you only played 148. And I'm not going to watch baseball anymore. I think optically that was huge for that negotiation.
Brett Boone with us for a few minutes. You can find his content on the Boone podcast. Good to have Brett with us, three-time All-Star, joining us here for a few minutes talking about Major League Baseball. All right, Freddie Freeman signs with the Dodgers, and your initial reaction is what?
One of the best players in the game. Dodgers just retained that top spot as team to beat. You know, they lose Seager, who I'm a big fan of Seager. You know, he plays the shortstop position, toughest position on the field, and he's a big producer. Problem with Seager lately is he's had trouble staying on the field. Freddie Freeman, just an elite hitter. I mean, I've got to consider him top three, top four in the game on the offensive side. I think what you hear about him off the field from everybody, you know, from the organization to everybody that's played with him, just a great guy in the clubhouse. Man, it seems like the big boys just get stronger, you know. So that puts Dodgers at the top of the lot for me, team to beat coming out of spring training.
Okay, so if you had to face Mookie Betts or Freddie Freeman.
I'm going to go with Mookie Betts. who do I have in the mound?
Yeah, that's right. That's you right. Know? I mean, that is the question. And I guess from the point of view as a fan looking at the Dodgers and sitting here in the National League West, where the team out here is basically waving the white flag already in the Diamondbacks. But you look at the National League West, and unless their pitching gets hit by injury, they can withstand losing Betts. They could withstand even losing Freeman for a period of time because they're so loaded, Brett.
They're so deep. They work the count. They give you tough at bats. You know, when it starts, you got the obvious Freeman, Betts, Muncy, Bellinger, former MVP, Muncy. I mean, it never stops. And the role players on that team, they're so deep. That's what you don't talk about, that you don't hear that much about the Dodgers. If they go down, if their big boys go down, they're so deep on that bench, and they just keep throwing really great players at you. They got a great bullpen. They got a great starting rotation. Kershaw getting a little older, but he's still Kershaw. And if he has to file back in that 3 or 4 hole, I think that's pretty good 3 or 4 guy in Clayton Kershaw, one of the greatest to ever do it.
Okay, over in San Diego, Bob Melvin, love Bo Mel. He was here with the Diamondbacks when they won the World Series. Went and did it in Oakland. He comes into San Diego and immediately finds out that his star player, Fernando Tatis, is out with a motorcycle injury to his body. All right. How do you handle this, Brett?
Very, very just signed, obviously, a huge deal. Yeah. One of the young stars, maybe the face of baseball right now. Fernando Tatis Jr., 22, 23 years old. And I remember when I was 22 or 23, that's what you do. You go motorcycle riding with your buddies. Man, you know, if it were a different player in different circumstances, you might see a different outcome right now. They might be sitting at home with a voided contract. As we know, you know, I have it hits close to home for me. Aaron Boone, 2003 in the offseason pickup basketball, blew out his ACL. Next thing you know, the Yankees voided his contract. But Aaron Boone and Tatis at this time in their career, a little different animals. Tatis, like I said, one of the young up and coming. I mean, not up and coming superstars of the game. You got to grow up a little bit. But once again, he is. We forget these players, how young they really are. And they're still 23 year old young men that don't always make the best decisions. I know I didn't, but they'll get past it. That San Diego Ball Club, I'll tell you, I've got high hopes. And I still think the National League West is definitely the class of baseball. You know, you go over to the Giants, and I wrote down a few things. Rodon comes over. You lose Gausman, but Rodon, everybody didn't give the Giants their due last year. Next thing you know, they're knocking at the door of the World Series. I still think that's the class of baseball, that National League West. And I think the Padres, with their kind of epic collapse in the second half of the 2021 season, they've got a lot to prove. You mentioned Bo Mel. He was my skipper his rookie year in Seattle in 2003. I think we were all surprised this offseason when you heard it announced. You just think Melvin, he's going to stay with the Oakland A's. Next thing you know, he signs with the Padres. And it kind of stunned me for a minute. I didn't see that coming, but I thought, wow, what a great pick for a manager to turn around that game in San Diego, because there's definitely a lot of talent down there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess Machado, it falls on Machado. I thought Bo Mel, when he said the opening day of spring training that Tatis's motorcycle days of riding are gone. Now, Bob might have said that tongue in cheek, or maybe he was straight up and he wants to sit and visit with the kid. But there's really not much you can do. And it does fall on Machado now, right?
I think you saw a big difference in Machado last year. Machado, you know, through his career, especially in the Oriole days, he had a lot of moments where he said, wow, that's pretty immature behavior. I think last year, and it was caught on camera, and I think you remember this, when Tatis and Machado had that moment in the dugout. Everybody was up in arms. Oh, that's bad for the clubhouse. I thought it was great for the clubhouse. I thought it was a growing moment. I think it was a time for Manny Machado to turn it from a kid, a young, great player, into a mature veteran big leaguer. And it was a teaching moment for him. I think Tatis has the utmost respect for Machado. And that moment right there, I think, if anything, brought that team closer together. And I'm sure, you know, the next day they came to the ballpark and probably gave each other a hug. But it was kind of like, hey, kid, I've done this before. I've made these mistakes before. You need to be a professional. Go out there and do your job. And I thought it was really cool, because Manny's had so many moments in his young career. And all of a sudden, he was that salty veteran that was taking this young superstar under his wing and giving him a teaching moment. I think Machado's ready for the spotlight and to be that go-to guy in San Diego as the leader of that ball club.
All right, Colorado gets Chris Bryant. I think that's big. Obviously, he's going to hit a lot of bombs up there with the Rockies. And then here in the Diamondbacks spot, it just feels like these guys are on audition. You don't want it to be that way, but this is just a – I don't want to say it's a double-A team, because that's an insult to the players. But, you know, Brett, what do you make out of what's going on here in Arizona? I'm not looking for deep insight. Madison Bumgarner is sitting there as the highest-paid player. It feels like around July 1st, someone's going to come along and say, okay. And then there's veterans like David Peralta and Nick Ahmed that are good veteran ball players. They're going to go out there and do their thing. And around July 1st, the trade deadline, it just feels like where we are in Arizona. Do you have a thought from a distance on what's going on over here?
I think that was a really good scenario you put out there when saying they're kind of on audition. You know, Baumgartner obviously has a storied career, big time postseason pitcher, one of the greatest of all time, by the way. And going back to that World Series in San Francisco, one of the most unbelievable performances I've ever seen by a pitcher in the postseason. That being said, he's on the backside. And I think you're exactly right. It's an audition, maybe one more chance to get back to the postseason for him. You mentioned mentioned, Ahmed, you got a couple really nice players in Arizona, but it kind of feels to me that they're kind of going that Orioles route, kind of the doormat, especially in that division, as we, you know, I mentioned at the top, best division in baseball. And it seems like it's going to be a long year. I've been on some teams like that a few years in my career. We're always so optimistic, though, coming out of spring training. You know, I'm sure they're hearing the talk right now with the big boys in that division and the Arizona players. I'm telling you, I've been there, and you don't tend to look in the mirror and check reality when you're in spring. Everything is optimistic. And you know what? We're going to overcome all this and some players are going to emerge. That rarely happens. But I'll tell you, those players in Arizona right now aren't thinking like we are, like you've got no chance and you're going to be the doormat of the league. They're going to come out fighting, ready to go. And if anything else, those veteran players are going to be playing, like you mentioned, kind of an audition for them this year, but I don't see Arizona going anywhere in the near future.
That's how most of us are feeling out here. But spring holds eternal. We're not wet blankets, Brett.
That's right. Especially for the young players. You know, this is an exciting time. You got guys out there trying to make a team. We were all there at one point, and you're not thinking about who's winning the division. You're thinking about if I can stay in the big leagues. So it's cool to watch, but from a fan's perspective, Arizona, I don't think you have much to look forward to this year.
Hit them straight. Break. What would be a good day for you today? Breaking 90?
80. Yeah. I'm looking at 78, 79. Wow. I played this course quite a bit. But like I said, how my back will hold up, that's going to be how I play it. I've been putting terrible, Brad. I've been hitting it tee to green. I've been hitting it pretty well lately. The putter's really let me down.
All right. Get out there. Do your thing, Brett. Thanks for the visit.
You got it. Thanks, Brett.
Brett Boone, the Boone Podcast. Make sure you check it out, the Boone Podcast. And we're back with more after this timeout.